You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Joe Bowler. Joe is a professor of education and equity at Stanford University and the faculty director of U-Cubed, an education resource that has reached over 230 million students. She is the author of the first MOOC on mathematics teaching and learning, as well as 9 mathematics books and numerous research articles. Her work has been published in the New York Times, Time Magazine, The Telegraph, The Atlantic, and The Wall Street Journal. She was named by the BBC as one of 8 educators changing the face of education. And she has a new book. It's called Limitless Mind, Learn, Lead, and Live Without Barriers. Dr. Joe Bowler, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
In the introduction of your new book, you write, quote, "Almost every day I meet people who believe damaging ideas about themselves and their learning," end quote. So I guess if I told you that I always thought I didn't have a mind for math, I would be added to that list, correct?
Absolutely, yes. So many people think that they haven't got a maths brain or some other sort of brain.
But it's not true, and you have science to back that up.
No, what we now know is that every time we learn something, our brain forms new connections and either forms new pathways or strengthens or connects pathways, and our brains are constantly changing.
So one of the things that we talk about in the field of improvisation is that you cannot improvise well if you're working out of fear, that fear is the enemy of creativity and innovation as we know it in our work. And that seems to be the same in the face of like even doing math.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right, yes. When people are anxious, actually we know that if you're anxious about maths, for example, every time you see numbers, a fear center lights up in the brain. And it's the same fear center that lights up when we see snakes and spiders.
So the other thing that I found interesting, and I remember my friend Allison Wood Brooks, who's at Harvard, I was talking to her this years ago, and I was doing a lot of speaking dates after I released my book. And I said, you know, it's interesting. I speak in public all the time, but I get really nervous. And she said, tell yourself out loud you're excited rather than say you're nervous. And that sent me on this path of like, oh, words are important. And you bring up that words can also be damaging, right?
So, yeah, the words we use are really important for people's learning. So when we praise them with fixed words and we say things like you're smart and you're gifted, even though that seems good, it sets people on a path of being very vulnerable and always wanting to keep that label, so they choose easy work.
So like if you were to say to your kid, you're so smart, that's you're sort of imprinting something that is negative.
Yes, what we know now is that when you praise your own kids and you say you're so smart, what they hear is, oh, great, I'm smart. But then when they mess up on something, which they will, everybody does, they think, oh, I'm not so smart. And they're always evaluating themselves against this fixed idea.
Obviously the podcast is called Getting to Yes And, based on my book, Yes And. And what the term in improvisation is all about, you know, we understand that people's default setting is to do nothing or say no. And so we create these exercises around not just saying yes, but saying yes and. I thought it was really interesting, and I think it came from Carol Dweck's work. You can correct me on that if I'm wrong, but the idea of the word yet and using that. So talk to us a little bit about why that is a better way, a better word.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that word. I use it with my own children, actually, because often they'll say things like, oh, I don't know how to draw, or I can't make this equation, or whatever they say. And I say to them, you mean you don't know how to draw yet? It's probably really annoying for them, but it sort of changes their ideas from I have this or I don't to, oh, it's a learning process. And that is a really important change.
That's a nudge. So you talk in the book about neuroplasticity. And I actually don't think that that has come up a lot on the podcast, which surprises me because it is very connected to sort of improvised behaviors. But talk to us about this. The research started with mapping the brains of monkeys, right? Am I correct on that?
Yeah. Neuroplasticity was discovered by accident, actually, at first, when they were mapping out the minds of monkeys and look at their brain pathways. And then they took a break and they went back to their mind maps and realized the monkeys' brains had really changed. And that was the beginning of them realizing that, oh, you know, brains are changing all the time. And at first, when they published this, people ridiculed them and they said, you know, that's ridiculous. Everybody knows your brain is fixed when you're born or maybe when you become an adult. And they had a lot of pushback. Now, many years later, people recognize they were wrong to give that pushback because we know that brains are constantly changing. Every single day, your brain is different from the day before.
And I guess the study that sort of illustrates this kind of beautifully is the one that they did in London with all these cabbies in the black cabs.
Yeah, that was one of the first studies. And that was particularly important because they saw that extensive brain growth in adults. So they realized that black cab drivers in London have to go through an extensive spatial learning process. When they're tested, they have to know 20,000 roads in London and all the connections between. So it's very complicated. And so they decided to check the brains of cab drivers after they go through this spatial training. And they found exactly that the hippocampus in their brains had significantly grown. And then, years later, when they retire from being a cab driver, the hippocampus shrinks back down again. So this is the huge brain plasticity.
It shrink back down, but that's not that's simply because it's not in practice, not in use, correct?
Yes, so it isn't because they retired and got older,
right?
They stopped using them, and we know that there's this thing in brain science called competitive space, and your brain really keeps the areas active that it really needs. So if you stop doing something and you let go of it completely, those brain areas that have been developed fade away, and other ones come into the picture.
So another quote in the book was, quote, every single day when we wake up in the morning, our brains are different than they were the day before. Is that true for everyone? No matter whether you've been involved in some sort of high brain exercise, it is always changing, always different?
I think it's true for everybody because every time you get a new idea or you learn something new, which of course we're all doing all the time, you don't just learn when you're in school or college, we're always going around learning new things. It sparks things in the brain, it sparks pathways. And so I can fully believe that every day you wake up, your brain has changed because you've had this whole day of experiences. I mean, maybe if you slept the whole day,
yes,
then your brain wouldn't change. But I'm sure that we're constantly having these experiences that change our brains.
All right. So there was all these aha moments as I'm reading the book, and you're going to recognize why when I talk to you about this. So in improv, we have all these adages that we use. And some of the most popular ones are make mistakes work for you and see all obstacles as gifts. There's science behind actually those ideas, correct?
Yeah, those are really in tune to the things I talk about in the book. This brain scientists now, you know, they've studied people while they work on tests, and they find that every time they make a mistake, there's synapses firing. There's more brain growth when you make a mistake than when you get work correct. And the very best times for our brains are when we're struggling, when we're finding things difficult, when we're making mistakes. That's when our brains are sort of on fire with growth.
You read the book, quote, mistakes grow your brain. It's not just that you're making mistakes all unconnected to anything else, right? There's a purpose involved, an end goal. There's got to be some sort of like surrounding conditions.
That's a good question. I don't think they know exactly what the different circumstances that cause the best brain growth or the best kind of mistakes.
Yeah.
I would imagine that more conceptual mistakes are more important than just, say, a slip where you don't do something because you didn't put the right number in or whatever. Because I think the reason mistakes are so productive is because times of struggle are really productive. So if your brain, if you're really finding something really difficult, that is the best time for your brain. And those are the times when we make those mistakes. So I think, I would imagine, I'm not sure that we have definitive answers on this, but I think the best kinds of mistakes are those sort of really deep thinking mistakes rather than just an error.
And this sort of bridges to ideas around failure. And we have an entire chapter in our book about failure because improvisers fail so much and they really become.
Yeah,
and this, the ability to be resilient and be agile comes from those failures. And you say, quote, the idea of seeing failure as opportunity. So talk about that in a learning sort of context.
Yeah, well, I'd say that many children, millions of children probably, go through the school year at first being really excited for everything they're going to learn, and then when they see somebody solving something more quickly or it seems more easy for them, they get the idea, I'm not as good as them. And when they start thinking these negative ideas about themselves, their brains actually function less well. The positive beliefs, believing you can do something, believing that you're capable of anything, actually helps your brain function in the most optimal way. So it's really important that people, when people fail, they have a different approach to it and they think, oh, well, you know, that was probably really good for my brain. I'm going to keep going and see if I can be successful rather than fail or struggle and think, oh, I'm not good. I'm just going to give up.
You talk about a study at Stanford, and there were MRI scans of two different groups. One was children.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that study and the brain differences were actually surprising.
Yes, that was interesting. So in this study, researchers brought in children, some of whom were regular performers in maths, and some of them had been given the label in school as having a learning disability in maths. And they first looked inside their brains while they worked on maths problems, and they found there were actual brain differences. And the brain differences were the kids who were diagnosed as having a learning disability had more of their brains lighting up than the kids who were regular performers when they worked on a problem. Now, that is sort of counterintuitive. I think many people think of kids with learning disabilities as having less going on in their brains, but you know, sometimes it can be too much. But they worked with both groups of students for a focused period of time. I think it was 8 weeks. And at the end of that period, not only did the two groups have the same achievement, but they had the exact same brain functioning. So you probably know our school system is built around the idea of identifying what kids can and can't do and then teaching them differently. But this research really calls that into question because we don't know what kids are capable of. And if a small 4-week intervention can completely level the playing field, we should probably really rethink these practices in schools.
Yeah, I've had this conversation with my friend Scott Barry Kaufman. He wrote a book called Ungifted because he was identified as someone with learning disabilities. And this guy's a genius. And you recognize that whenever you talk to Scott, it's like there's so much going on in his head that it might appear to someone that he's like, you know, on the spectrum, not getting it or whatever. But it's just like that brain is so active.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I've not ever found any students I work with who aren't capable of doing great things if you have high expectations for them and you set out learning in a way that's accessible to them. Yet so many teachers and parents and people think that students are of some different set ability and some students can do things and some students can't. And no, people like Scott, like really everybody is capable of amazing work and thinking with the right circumstances?
So my kids both went to Chicago Waldorf schools. And one of the things I loved about that was, you know, they do lots of arts, which I think is good. Mm-hmm. But also, like, you know, when they are talking about history, they have them paint, or, you know, the scenes from history, or they play. Uh-huh. You know, they have a drama block where they'll play, you know, the characters that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you talk about this and this idea of multidimensional approach to teaching and learning. So talk to us about why that's so important.
Yeah, it turns out that we have these different pathways in the brain. And in maths, for example, every time you work on a maths problem, there's five different areas in the brain that light up. Two of them are visual pathways. Mm-hmm. Our brains want to think visually about maths, about everything, really. But what's really important is to have those pathways communicate with each other. So when we approach content in different ways, just as you describe in the Waldorf schools, or one of the examples I often give is to give people a math problem with numbers, but also with visuals, mm-hmm. and so they can see it and see the idea. So when you approach it in different ways, that's what causes this brain communication to happen. And the most high-achieving people in our society, when they've looked inside their brains, they see more brain communication between these different areas. And what brings about that brain communication is seeing content ideas in different ways. So maybe you're painting or using numbers or words or moving or building. And when you're doing different things to approach the same idea, that causes this great brain communication.
I had a not pleasant flashback reading this chapter because I remember distinctly, you know, I struggled with math, and I remember my teacher, like, I tried to count stuff out with my fingers, and this was when I was young, and they were like, "You can't do that," like that was cheating, and
Right. That's
not the case.
No, and that's still happening all over the country.
I bet it is.
Kids are being made to feel bad for using their fingers. Yeah, that's some of the most surprising research that I think is really interesting. Turns out that even in a room of adults, if you ask them to work on a maths problem, an area of their brain will light up that's seeing fingers. And the harder the problem, the more likely that brain area is to light up. And so it turns out knowing your fingers really well increases your maths achievement. And what they call finger perception, a test for finger perception is if you put your hands under a book or a table and have somebody touch the fingertips at different places or parts of the finger, and if you can name which finger is being touched, then that's a sign of good finger perception. If you try it with young children, you'll find that they're just developing this finger perception. But it turns out finger perception is that in grade 2 is a better predictor of achievement in grade 3 than kids' test scores are.
Mm.
So fingers are so important. Even college students, how well they know their fingers predicts how well they do on calculation tests.
That's fascinating.
So we know the fingers are super important. It actually connects to this area of the brain. But all over the country, kids are being made to feel bad about using their fingers. And so that's part of the research we've been really keen to get out to a broader public.
The other sort of sobering, one of the other sobering ideas in this book was the idea around the bias that is inherent mm-hmm. in giftedness. Mm-hmm. So that, and you're saying that is both, there's gender bias and racial bias.
And racial bias, that's right, yeah. It's very interesting. So these ideas of people being gifted or having special talent, any of these fixed ideas, turns out they're damaging for a number of reasons. One is they give fixed messages to people, but they're also very gendered and racialized. One of the studies that showed it very clearly looked into university professors and asked, how much does it matter if they think you need a gift to be successful? And it turned out to matter a lot. This was published in Science, because the more any field valued that idea of giftedness, the fewer women and the fewer students of color were in that field. Because we know once college professors or teachers give out those ideas and say things like, oh, only a few of you will be successful in this class, it is women and students of color who are sitting there thinking, oops, that's probably not me. And we also know, I thought this was interesting, the most commonly Googled word that comes after "is my 2-year-old son" is the word gifted. But that sentence is Googled 2.5 times more than "Is my daughter gifted?"
That comes from Seth Stevens Davidovitz, who we've had on the podcast.
Yeah, that's right,
amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, it just shows how people hold these ideas even subconsciously. I'm sure they don't even realize that they're thinking these things.
But
these words are really, yeah.
But the belief cuts both ways, right? So the idea is, you know, people can have these biases and these beliefs, but when you believe in yourself that you can, you know, do this, you're saying that the belief is actually the important thing.
Yeah, there's really incredible research on this. One of the areas of research that I find most amazing is in beliefs and health.
Mm-hmm.
So they followed something like 61,000 people over 21 years and found that the people who believed their exercise was healthy were actually more healthy than people who did the same amount of exercise but didn't believe it was healthy. So, and then the negative thinkers were 71% more likely to die in the follow-up period. So it turns out it's really important what you believe about yourself. And similar results with learning. When people believe they can learn anything, turns out they go on to learn more. And we know why, because if you have positive beliefs about yourself and then you make a mistake, your brain is much more active with growth than if you have negative beliefs about yourself and you make a mistake. So it actually changes. What we believe about ourselves actually changes how our brains function.
I've told this story before, but I just find it funny. So Tina Seelig is a friend, a colleague of yours at Stanford.
Yes.
And she was working on something around luck. And my wife said to her, he's like, you know what, Kelly's very lucky at finding a parking space. And she's like, well, what I would say is that Kelly believes there is always a parking space for him. So he's more likely to see the one that's there. Whereas other, and you're like, and it was very, it dawned on me. It's like, oh no, I have that outlook that this stuff is going to work out. And a lot of times it does. And I think that crosses some of these contexts, and it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's right. Another of the studies I really liked was they took hotel cleaners and they gave half of them the message that their work cleaning hotels satisfied the Surgeon General's recommendations for a healthy lifestyle. They told the other group nothing, and they watched them for 4 weeks, no changes in their behavior. But at the end of the four-week period, the people they told that their work was healthy had this whole list of health advantages. They had lower BMI and better heart functioning and better, just a whole range of better statistics. So it's really interesting. It changes your learning. It changes your health. And it probably does change whether you see parking spaces or not.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about being fast, about speed. Is speed of thinking a quality that measures, you know, overall aptitude?
So one of the messages I'm very keen to give in the book is that speed is not a measure of aptitude. And I work in the field of mathematics mostly, which is a field where most people believe that you have to be speedy with numbers to be good at maths. But the irony of that is mathematicians, some of the greatest mathematical thinkers, are usually very slow. They're very deep thinkers. But we're in this school system where we're constantly putting kids under speed pressure. And what that does is the kids who are those slow, deep, creative thinkers get the idea, I can't be a maths person or anything else that uses these speed measures. So it's really important to dial back on speed. We also know that when you're working under any form of pressure, that creative side of your brain shuts down. So if we want this deep, creative, flexible thinking, which we do need for the 21st century, but we're putting kids in classes under speed pressure all the time, they're just not developing that part of their brain.
My neighbor Josh is fifth grade math teacher here in Chicago. Mm. And I actually just finished reading part of your book when I was coming in the house and I saw him. He loved this study. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce the name right. Cyan Bylock, that research.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about math anxiety and parenting, because I think this thing is like the most sticky thing in the book for many people.
Yeah. So what they found was when they studied students' achievement that the more maths anxiety parents had, the less well their students achieved over a school year. But the amount of maths knowledge they had didn't make any difference. It was to do with how anxious they were about maths, but only if they helped with homework. This is somewhat of a relief to people I know who are afraid of maths. And you can imagine how that works, because if you're a parent with maths anxiety, but you never interact around maths with your kids, then maybe you don't pass that on. But if you are and you're helping them with homework, you're probably saying things like, oh, this was really hard for me when I was in school. And those are the messages that immediately bring down kids' achievement. So, yeah, I thought that was a really interesting one. Sam Bylock's also the neuroscientist who's shown that speed and time pressure blocks the working memory in the brain, which is the part of the brain we need to do mathematical calculations.
Mm. All right. Here's another moment where I was excited about the book based on our work. So another improv adage is all of us are better than one of us. And we preach collaboration, and we talk about the need for ensemble and diverse point of views. And this idea that you say, quote, collaboration is vital for learning. So tell us why from this point of view.
Well, we know that when you connect with somebody else's idea, whatever subject you're learning, it actually requires more understanding to do that. It also develops more understanding. And so connecting around ideas is very important. As I said, I work in maths mainly, and it's something we don't see enough of in maths. Kids think it's a very individual activity. But when we have kids connecting around the ideas, they're developing really important brain areas. I also talk in the book about ways of connecting. It's a problem in education often when there are status differences between kids and they don't treat each other with respect. And it turns out that when people learn the ideas in the book about how important it is to struggle and to embrace uncertainty and to be in that place of uncertainty, it causes people to interact much better with each other. And they're not trying to be kind of know-it-all, and they're not trying to put each other down. And they're much more open to asking each other questions. And that kind of collaboration is much more effective.
So I loved that. And you talk about the sort of building generations of people who are kind and respectful and respect diversity and diverse point of views. I also thought it was tremendously brave that you talked about your own bullying. And you name him. His name is James Milgram. And I was like, she's naming him. And I know it's been online, and it sparked me, because when I first got the book, I didn't know that I knew you. And then I'm like, oh, I know about this. So talk to us about, if you will, and we don't have to go hugely into it, but, you know, what did this person do?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So this guy, Milgram, is a mathematician who just believes that kids should sit in rows and be taught procedures. And he's very firm in his belief about that. So when I came to the US at first, and I had this research evidence that actually when we have kids work together on projects and talk about maths, they're more successful. So he was very threatened by this. I had actual evidence. And at first he told me, just don't talk about your research in the US. I was like, okay. But then when another study came out with the same results, he did something which is very dangerous for a person, and I'm sure he knew that, which is he accused me of academic misconduct. He said that I've made up data. So that was a huge claim. Stanford, by law, had to investigate it. It's federal law. They found no evidence at all that backed up his claim. And so they abandoned the investigation, and they said, we're not going any further with it. So he then just took to the internet and made these claims on the internet. And initially, it was such a horrible experience for me. I actually left the States. I left Stanford. I went back to England. And then a few years later, Stanford kept asking me to come back. I thought, you know what? I'll come back, but I need to fight this. And I had a great dean who's called Claude Steele. He's an amazing academic. And he said, look, you should just publish everything they've done to you. And I remember the Friday night I decided to publish it, and everybody else had gone off to this faculty party, and I stayed at home. I joined Twitter that night. I'd never been on Twitter before. And I just published all the things they'd done about trying to suppress my research and bring it down. And I put it on Twitter, and it quickly that weekend went viral. I was contacted by news reporters. And so that was a big moment for me. But what happened after that was the most interesting, because people started contacting me. I had about 100 emails and letters from other women scientists saying, you know, I've experienced this kind of academic bullying. And so as time went on, those connections were really healing for me. And probably, I mean, people say to me now, I should send him a bunch of flowers because there were teachers all across the country who had also been impacted by this man and the others he works with. And they sort of said, they said to me, thank you for standing up to him. We needed someone to do that. And probably it has helped messages get out further that we did that. So, yeah, that was a pretty interesting period of my life.
Well, that's the idea around seeing obstacles as gifts. I don't think he deserves flowers. Don't send him flowers is my advice. But you know, this is the idea around like post-traumatic stress, right? Or, you know, the idea that you can take these, you know, terrible things. And there's quite a bit of study, right, around that in different fields and contexts. But that you can use that and to grow yourself and grow your mind and grow the person you are when you walk in the world. And I imagine that, you know, there was a lot of anxiety and fear. You skipped town. But then, you know, being able to sort of like conquer it has got to have you coming out the other side a better human.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old expression, I guess, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. And I think I could have, I mean, at first when it happened to me, I withdrew, as I think a lot of people do. And, you know, my home in England started to seem more appealing to me. But over time, I decided I have to fight this. And I think that's right. I think people, you know, if you can take adversity and counter it, there are really amazing things on the other side of that. And now I still get a lot of criticism and pushbacks, especially on social media, people who are anonymous. But now I think, well, if they're coming after me and attacking me like that, my ideas must be making a difference.
And
you know, if you're not getting pushback, there's so much wrong with our system. Maybe you're not being strong enough, and maybe you need to be more, you know, make stronger statements even. So I've tried to myself to turn around any aggressive or, you know, pushback behavior and really see it as an opportunity.
The way we end our podcast is we always ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, we understand when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they really don't get anywhere by saying no, and they don't get very far by saying yes. They kind of tend to stay in the middle. But when they yes and, they're affirming and contributing, and that allows them to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Huh, that's an, I hadn't really thought about it in that way until you just asked me that question, but I can think, I guess, about a bit about that. I mean, the times for me that are harder that I don't just jump into and say, yes, I'll do that, which is probably different from you and other people you hang out with, is things like drama and or going to parties. Going to parties is very scary for me.
Oh, no.
I'm much more likely to jump into a math problem than I am to go to a party and feel okay about it. But I remember, actually, a couple of things where I've pushed through into an area that was really out of my comfort zone. One of them was when I joined a drama production, actually, when I was a college student. And I was one of those people, like, I'm not a drama person, just as I think of try and change those messages about maths, but I said yes anyway, and I went into this production, and it was probably one of the most fantastic things I've ever done.
Oh, great.
One of the strongest memories of my college was being in that drama production. So I don't know if that's the kind of thing that you're thinking about.
But. Yeah, well, absolutely. So, all right, so I have a couple, I have follow-up questions.
Okay.
One is, when you push yourself to go to the party, how was your experience at the party?
Usually good.
Okay.
I'm just you know, I'm very shy. So the thought of going to a party and meeting new people and chatting with people I don't know mm-hmm. is kind of scary. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, I often make myself go. And then there are friends that I know, and that's really nice. And I can connect with people again. So I don't think I ever regret going.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's something I have to push myself into.
Sure. And then with regard to the theatrical production, I mean, this is to your point about collaboration, right? It is such a... none of it works if not everyone is, you know, working together. And that becomes a very powerful sort of undercurrent in those experiences. And I think it's why people who are in productions together bond so well and sort of stay friends, even though they may never work again together.
Yeah, I think so. It's really a great collaboration. And we were a team and we, you know, celebrated together and we did lots of, we learned together. And yeah, I see that a lot. We run summer camps every few years at Stanford where we invite kids in from sort of underserved communities and they don't know each other, but they come and we get them doing this really creative maths together and they bond with each other and they form new friendships and they stay connected afterwards. So I think that human connection is really important.
Especially today.
Especially today, yeah.
The book is called Limitless Mind, Learn, Lead, and Live Without Barriers. Jo Bowler, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.